Okay, I want to make sure that all of you have noted in your prayer list that the Honduras mission team is, as far as we know, on the field now. And some of you may remember last week that when we mentioned this, Letha Bryant, who I think attends the other hour, so maybe you don't know this, said, well, I'm going on a mission trip too, apparently through another group. I don't know what that group is, but she was going to be in Peru for about the same length of time, and I think we all want to be remembering her as well. Chris? I do want to point out to you that many of you will read in the newspaper Randy Fitzgerald's column in the Wednesday paper. It comes in your section. I forget what the rest of it's called. His wife has the same name as mine, and he has an abbreviation for her. He calls her Barb, but there might be a reason for that. I do want to point out to you that the morning paper has a very interesting cartoon in it. You can look at the details of it later, but it's Foxtrot, and the young man in the family is standing by the stairs shouting upstairs, Mom, Dad, shouldn't we be leaving for church? You don't want us to be late, do you? The service starts in less than 2 hours, and who knows how long it'll take to park. I'll be waiting out in the car, okay? And then finally over on the right, there's a panel that shows the husband standing there with a towel around his waist shaving, his wife behind him doing her toothbrush. And the husband says, he really thinks Palm Sunday means free handheld computers, doesn't he? There are times when the cartoons get a little bit vicious, but they're still funny. Okay. We are looking this morning again at 1 Peter, and I want to take one more pass through some things in a section that starts in verse 13 and runs through verse 25. This is in chapter 1, 1 Peter chapter 1. We're looking at a section that starts in verse 13 and runs through verse 25. Now, hidden in these verses is a contrast, and that contrast is perhaps most appropriate at this time of year. The contrast is between a Christ-less life and a Christ-filled life. And what I want to do is walk with you through this to look at that. There's actually three things on each side of the ledger that are talked about it here. Before I do that, though, what I want to do is take you out to a couple of other places. There's several places we could go. We're going to go to two other places just to look at the contrast that's set up by Paul in a couple of places. There's one that's in 2 Timothy. And so if you'll back up a few books to 2 Timothy. In this particular place, the list on this side is much, much longer than the list on that side. It's in 2 Timothy chapter 3, the first 5 verses. Easter time is different from Christmas. Easter time is different from Christmas. What's the difference? Easter's the real thing. Easter is the culmination and the fulfillment. Christmas is the promise. Christmas, you look forward to Jesus coming. Easter, you ponder why he came. You ponder the significance of all he did. And what he did was to make it possible for God's Spirit to live inside of you. for you to live a Christ-filled life. And so it's appropriate for us today. This just happens to be where we've hit. But it's appropriate for us today to take a look at the contrast between the two. The contrast is stark. And if you don't have to look too hard to see it at work in the world. Take a look at 2 Timothy chapter 3. My translation says you may be quite sure that in the last days there will be some difficult times. Verse 2, people will be. And the description that follows is a description of people who are living a Christ-less life. All I want to do is get some words down because they're pretty harsh. What are the words? Okay. Mine says self-centered. Yours said egoists. Yours said lovers of self. Lovers of money. Now there's a nice parallel in the first two, lovers of self, lovers of money, but the translation that does the one will probably do the other. Mine says avaricious. Avaricious. Could have said greedy, I guess. What's the third one?
Ungrateful.
Sometimes the order is a little different from one translation to another. Boastful. Uh-huh. Okay. Mine says arrogant. Yours says proud. Rude. None of that around in our world, right?
Disobedient to their parents.
Yeah. Disobedient to their parents. Unloving, ungrateful. That's the one that I thought might have been out of order because it shows up in a different place than mine. Okay? Mine says irreligious. What's the difference between unreligious and irreligious? I did catch that difference in wording. What's the difference between unreligious and irreligious? I don't know for sure. I think unreligious says you just sort of put that aside. Irreligious says you make fun of those who find some meaning there. I don't know which of the two they're talking about because the translations use both words. Different translations use each of
them. Talking at God.
Okay, and that sounds more like the second of those, which is why irreligious might be a little bit better one. Okay. Does yours keep going?
Yeah.
Mine's got about another 15, right?
Irreconcilable.
Mine says heartless and intractable. Irreconcilable. Ungrateful keeps showing up at different places, doesn't it? Heck, I don't know. When you look through the translations, that's the word that seems to move around. That's the one that seems to move around. In some translations, it's early. In some translations, it's sort of in the middle. Mine says heartless. That might be another word for brutal, might it? Yeah. That might be a variation on this one, mightn't it? And it could consider nothing sacred. Now, the question I'm asking as we go through this, do you see signs of this in the world we live in? Let me remind you what the first verse says. You may be quite sure that when? In the last days. What are the last days? The time when Jesus coming, second coming, is imminent. Yeah. I think there might be differences. Yeah. I think there might be differences. Yeah. Mine says slanderers, profligates, savages, and enemies of everything that is good. I don't know that I'll write all of those things down. Yeah, keep your eye on malicious gossips. Keep your eye on malicious gossip. That one shows up a little bit later. It's probably not worth spending the time on it, but what's the difference between a gossip and a malicious gossip? I am so glad you winked in the middle of that. Mine says enemies of everything that is good. Yeah, that's where it culminates in verse 5. That's where it culminates in verse 5. Mine says, treacherous, reckless, demented by pride, preferring their own pleasure to God, they will keep the outward appearance of religion. I think your translation is actually better than that. But will have rejected the inner power of it. Read your translation for verse 5 one more time. Having a form. This might be the appearance. Okay, keep your eye on that one too. Keep your eye on that one too. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power of it. Yeah, my translation said keep away from people like that. And again, I think the key to that last phrase is right here. They are not only not neutral towards religion, they have chosen a position that opposes everything that's good, opposes everything that's God.
We just eliminate a person when they just control the rank that everybody's going to be after that position.
So what are the characteristics of a Christ-filled life? If you'll go down to verse 10, my translation says, you, though, you could say, you, on the other hand, or you, in contrast, have followed my teaching, my way of life, my aims, my faith, my patience, my love, my joy, my perseverance. I think those four, towards the tail end of that, become things that we might write up. We see faith, we see patience, we see love, and we see perseverance. That's in verse 10 and in the verses that follow. It goes a little bit further than that. Okay? If you keep going, you come down to verse 15. Verse 14 says, you must keep to what you've been taught and know to be true. Remember who your teachers were and how ever since you were a child you've known the Holy Scriptures. From these you can learn the wisdom that leads to salvation. This brings with it a seeking after true wisdom. And if you look in between verse 10 and verse 14, 15, what you see is endurance in the face of persecution. Modern Americans don't necessarily have very much of that, but there's people around the world who do. Ken is here this morning. I think you may remember me quoting him in his absence a week or two ago when he returned from a trip to Southeast Asia. One of the things he told me, you may want to say more about this in just a second, was that when he was in China, where the punishment for openly speaking about faith and Christianity and such is quite severe. He was with Chinese Christians who just would not stop talking about it in public places. And he said he felt like saying to them, you know, tone it down a little bit. And they wouldn't do it. Because they felt what they had to say was more important than the punishment or the persecution that might come. We don't know as much about that. The day may come that we learn it, but we don't know that much about it right now. There's a contrast between these two. Last night at the forum, my nose was bleeding quite badly from the seat that I was sitting in. But Fred Thompson was there, formerly a senator from Tennessee and also a person who is seen quite often in things that Hollywood and so forth create. And he was asked in the question and answer period in the second half, why do people hate the United States? And he eventually got to one of the big answers, one of the things that I've heard, and that is that people around the world, and perhaps correctly, see the United States as a source of corruption for young people, especially what comes out of Hollywood. One of the most interesting things I've seen, there have been half a dozen studies that I've seen, some formal and academic, and some anecdotal and sort of just sort of looking at the trade magazines. But what they said is, if you look at the themes of movies and you look at the money they make, the movies that have wholesome themes out-earn the other movies by something like 5 or 6 or 7 to 1. And yet somehow Hollywood keeps making the movies that celebrate violence and celebrate depravity and celebrate other things. And they don't seem to be able to figure this out. There's a word for that, and the word that's used by the people who've done some of these studies is they are blind. They just don't even see the truth. And that's a piece of what's up here. There's a contrast between these two. More than anything else, Easter calls on us to recognize who Jesus is and the opportunity that's ours to have him come into our hearts and come into our lives and to replace this with that. Let's go look at the second one. This is in Galatians. This is the one that I think is the sharpest and the clearest of all of these. But sometimes when you see all of these set side, two or three of these set side by side, it sort of jumps out at you. Galatians, you have to back up a bit from Timothy. Remember, Timothy was one of the letters to the pastors called the so-called pastoral letters, and the church letters are before that. So if you can find Galatians, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and then Galatians. And I'm finding chapter 5. In my translation, the terms that Paul uses are not Christ-filled and Christ-less. He uses guided by the Spirit. Which one do you think that means? Christ-filled. And yielding to, my translation says, yielding to self-indulgence. All this is in verse 16 of chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 16. Actually, verse 15, if you go on snapping at one another and tearing one another to pieces, take care, you'll be eaten up one by the other. Instead, I tell you, this is verse 16, be guided by the Spirit, and you will no longer yield to self-indulgence. Now, what's your word for that? Led by the Spirit is a pretty good synonym for this. Yielding to self-indulgence, I don't think does much for me. Okay. Gratifying desires of, what was the rest of it? And the problem is that at salvation, the sin nature is no longer in control, but it's not gone. And so there's a tension that sometimes occurs in the lives of Christians, where you can have the Spirit but not be paying much attention. Now, the interesting thing is how similar the lists are. Now, once again, the list is quite a bit longer on the one side than it is on the other side. Maybe I won't take time to write every one of these down, but if I look at verse 17, the desires of self-indulgence are always in opposition to the Spirit. The desires of the Spirit are always in opposition to self-indulgence. They are opposites, one against the other. That's how you're prevented from doing the things you want to. But when you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. Now here's verse 19. This is the start of our list. When self-indulgence is at work, the results are obvious. Sexual vice, impurity, and sensuality. Do you see the word and in your translation? Does it land the same way it does in mine? Does yours just have a list without the word and in it? Okay, mind throws in the word ant as if you've got a group, sometimes two, sometimes three, sometimes four, and then there's another group, and then there's another group. Probably if we took the time to study, we might see things in common among those. We're not going to take the time this morning because we're going to go back and look at 1 Peter. There's a real short list back there, three on one side, three on the other side, and it brings these things into fairly stark contrast. Three on one side, maybe four on the other side. So here goes the first one. Sexual vice, impurity, and sensuality. Here's the second one. The worship of false gods and sorcery. What does yours say?
Idolatry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't forget that several places in the New Testament, it equates idolatry with greed. And it equates idolatry with arrogance. Greed is the attitude that I want something that I don't have, and arrogance is the attitude that says I deserve to have it, and I can take it away from you. Next group, antagonisms and rivalry. Next group, jealousy, bad temper, and quarrels. Next group, disagreements, factions, and malice. The next group, drunkenness, orgy, and all such things. And then he comes to verse 22. On the other hand, is that the way yours starts out, verse 22? Isn't that powerful? Yeah, just look at that first little phrase in my translation and look for something similar in yours. Mine says, on the other hand. Yours just says, but. Yeah, listen to that phrase, on the other hand. Here's one way to live. Here's another way to live. Now, these are grasped by most commentators. Mine doesn't divide them this way, but most commentators collect these in groups of three. Most commentators I've seen collect these in groups of three. Love, joy, and peace. Patience, kindness, and goodness. Trustfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And then this powerful phrase, they don't write laws to deal with these things. They don't write laws to deal with these things. You think about lawmakers, people in Congress, people in the House of Delegates in the Virginia Assembly. What do they write laws about? They don't write laws about love and joy. They don't write laws about gentleness and self-control. They write laws about sexual vice and about bad temper and quarrels and jealousy and about factions and malice and drunkenness and so forth. They don't write laws about things like this. Now, let's go back to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. We've already read through all the way down to 21. We worked through that last time, so we're coming back through a second time. But I want you to notice, all I'm picking out is just a couple of things in here. Okay. My translation says in verse 14, don't allow yourselves to be shaped by. Do you see that one? I think yours says don't be conformed to or don't be molded by. Okay. The word that jumps out at me is the last word that I have in verse 14, and that's ignorance. Christ-filled life is characterized as much as anything by ignorance. Ignorance about what things? How about for a second? Does ignorance mean stupidity? I work with this with my students on the first day of class in the first course that they take in chemistry. Does ignorance equate to stupidity?
No.
No, it's not. Ignorance means you are living your life unaware of. That's what ignorance means. It doesn't mean you can't know. It means you don't. And one of the things that they're ignorant about, they think people who live a... Gee, that was awful. Horrors, horrors, horrors. People who live a Christless life think that God is either unknowable or not worth knowing. And in that, they're ignorant. Because God is both knowable and supremely worth knowing. Verse 14 has the second one. My translation says, passions. What does yours say? Okay? dominated by lust, desire, selfishness, dominated by that. Don't allow yourselves to be shaped by that attitude that dominates all of life, by selfishness. Don't allow yourself to be shaped by your former ignorance. Dominated by desire, life lived in a constant grab for pleasure, no matter the cost. That's losing our world pretty big. Verse 18 has the next one. In the middle of something glorious, there is this one horrible word. Can you find it in your translation? Let me read it in mine, see if you can spot it. For you know that the price of your ransom from the futile way of life handed down by your ancestors. Did you hear it? Futile. The third characteristic is futility. Empty. I think that's a very good parallel. What else? Anybody else have one? Life going nowhere. There's nothing for which to live, and there's nothing for which to die. And the essence of futility is the attitude that says there's nothing on the other side of death. You're going to live just like dogs do? Why not live just like dogs do? There's nothing for which to live, nothing for which to die. Life is going nowhere. Empty is a real good parallel for that. Does anybody know the subject of the book of Ecclesiastes? King James translates it vanity, but that's not a very good translation for modern Americans. What's the subject of the book of Ecclesiastes? Futility. It's the frustration of someone who's trying to live a life, and all he sees in life is futility. He keeps getting these glimpses that there's something more, but he never finds it. The contrast between that book is most sharp with the book of Job. In the book of Job, the life that Job is living completely collapses, and yet he's still able to hold on, almost like a drowning man onto a piece of wood. He's still able to hold on to his faith. And at the end, he sees that much more clearly. It wasn't Solomon, the wisest man on earth, according to Scripture. It wasn't Solomon who said, I know my Redeemer lives. It was Solomon who said, everything is futile. It's all just chasing after the wind. Okay. The contrast to this, for the Christ-filled life. Let's see if we can find those. The first one is back in verse 15. It's actually two parts. Be holy, and what's the other word that pops up there? Mine says, as obedient children, be holy. Does yours have that somewhere nearby? Is that still in 14? Okay, that's the division. Obedience and holiness. One of the things that I've learned in teaching is if you say something more than once, you got a better chance of having people remember it. We're saying something more than once here. We talked about holiness on another week. What's the essence of holiness?
Holiness is the standard that always has to be over Jesus' time.
It comes out there, but there's something else that is really important to hear. Really important to hear. The essence of holiness is set apart, different. Not different just to be different. Not set apart just to be put over there. But set apart, different, in order to be of use in God's work. Now, the way you do that is that way. But the essence of it is different. How are Christians different for people who aren't Christians? How are people different from here to there? The difference is there's a purpose. Do you see how that contrasts with number three? Holiness is a call to separateness. Being part of the world, being in the world, but not being part of it. The essence here is to recognize we are chosen by God, we are God's children, and there are privileges associated with that. There are blessings associated with that. What the writer's pointing out is the responsibility. We're chosen for a task, and we're chosen for a task here, and we're chosen for a destiny in heaven to come. The call is for us to live for God in time and live with God in eternity. And living for God prepares us for living with God. The key to all of that is obedience. Were you all in the worship service this morning? Not yet. You missed the baptism. I'm on the back row of the choir loft. If I turn around, I see the wall. So I didn't see the gentleman who was baptized. I think I know who it is, but I'm not sure. Could you all see him? How old was he? Take a guess. 50, mid-40s, early 50s. They look younger the older we get, right? Okay. Yeah. He wasn't 12. He wasn't 9. And what was said about him? He's been a Christian for a long time, but he came out of a different tradition. Okay? So why was he being baptized? Obedience. Obedience. Because Christ said, my followers, when they become my followers, when they know they're my followers, the first act of obedience is baptism. And he says, I haven't had that. And our church had the privilege of providing that for him. Well, the difference is that in some traditions, there is baptism as infants and then confirmation later on. And that can be a very powerful engine. That is a very powerful engine. And it's very meaningful to folks. But Jesus said, I want my believers, people who come to follow me, to be baptized. And as our church understands that says the baptism follows the other. And I saw whatever else was going on this morning, more than anything, what I saw was an act of obedience. That's reasonably rare and should be celebrated. Let's come down to verse 17. If you address as Father him who judges without favoritism according to each individual's deeds, live out the time of your exile here in reverence. Mine says reverent awe. Okay. I'm going to just put reverence to sort of summarize that, because one of the big messages of Scripture is fear the Lord. And then once you come to fear the Lord, the next message is fear not. And if you walk through Scripture, you'll see those often. There is a fear, a respect for the Lord, a reverence for the Lord that is followed by knowledge, but the reverence is never lost. There's a whole bunch of things here. Did you hear the thing about exile? What does yours say about that? My translation says, live out the time of your exile here in reverent awe. Yours says strangers. Yours says what? Live as strangers, right? This is not our home. We live life thinking not only of where we are, but where we're supposed to be. A lot of people live life thinking only of where they are. There's a contrast between those two. We think about what we're doing here in light of that. Did you notice the comment about the judge earlier on in that sentence? God's going to judge. We live life in the light of the fact that there's going to be a reckoning. We're going to be asked to look at what we've done with the opportunities that were ours. And then finally, going on into verse 18, there was a price paid. An awesome price was paid for us to have the relationship with God. Mm-hmm. You put all those together and reverence flows out of that. Now, what's the last one? The last one is down in verse 22, and this starts the new part. I didn't want to jump into verse 22 without giving you a context to understand it. Verse 22 puts a third thing with this. A Christ-filled life is characterized by obedience and holiness. It's characterized by reverence, and it's characterized by one more thing. Can you find it? Love. Love for who? Now, this is a male-dominated society in which this was written, so I think we can say brothers and sisters without too much trouble. If we haven't figured out how to love each other, we're not going to do very well loving anybody else. Eternity has been put in my heart when I became Christian. Eternity has been put in your heart. The Spirit of Jesus lives in my heart. If you're a child of God, the Spirit of Jesus lives in your heart. How come we can't get along? There's an inconsistency there, and what we're being called on is to recognize these are the things that should characterize our life, and we should look to see if they're present. Eternity and immortality have found a home in us. And the greatest characteristic of the Christ-filled life is love. Now, from that, make the transition to chapter 2, verse 1. My first word says, rid yourselves, men. Those are my first words. Some translations say, strip off. Put aside. Okay? It says, rid yourselves. I don't have enough bumps in there. Put aside. What was the other one? Strip off. Okay. Do you see the word then in your translation? Or therefore? Okay. Do all of you know it's the most terrible cliche, but it's worth repeating? Does everybody know the cliche that goes with the word therefore? Anytime you see the word therefore, what are you supposed to do? Look to see what it's there for. Okay? I know, it's terrible, but it does make an important point. It's here because it's a transition to the heart of the previous verses. The heart of the previous verses said, you can live this way or you can live this way. God is calling you here. The Spirit in your heart puts you here, not here. Verse 1 of chapter 2 essentially says, now, if you're going to love the brothers, the way to do it is not to just push yourself up and start loving the brothers. The idea is to clear away the things that won't let you do that. Strip away the things that will. And then put one thing in place. And that's the purpose of these verses. Rid yourselves, my translation says, of spite. That's the first one. And that is nowhere near strong enough. Yours says malice. That's a lot better. But it doesn't really complete the job. You can't go to the second word yet. Stay with the first word. If anybody has a different translation for the first one. Yeah, those are the extra words. I'm looking for the very first word. There's four or five words across there. I'm looking for the first one. I'm told by the commentators that the first one is the big one and everything else is a descriptor or a specific or an example that fills out the meaning of the first one. The first one, in I guess maybe when I was 6 or 7 or 8, my mother might have used the word wickedness. It's a word we don't use that much anymore. It's the evil that characterizes this world. And the word spite doesn't do it. Malice comes pretty close. Malice comes pretty close. I think it was a guy named Hobbes with 2 B's and E and an S, and it's not the tiger that Calvin carried around. Thomas Hobbes, who described one time what life is like by a series of words. Anybody know that series of words? I think it said nasty, I think it said bloody, I think it said brutish, and I think it said short. Malice does that. malice does that. It's just, it's the evil that characterizes a godless wolf. All the other words are illustrations or manifestations of details of that one. So what's the first one? That's sort of the big one. So the first word is deceitfulness. What's deceitfulness? That's hypocrisy. I think they've got a separate word for that, don't they? I think hypocrisy shows up as the next word after that. So we've got to make a contrast between deceitfulness and hypocrisy. Deceitfulness is trickery. Yeah, hypocrisy is sort of what do I present? Trickery is sort of what do I get you to believe? Not about me necessarily, but about circumstance or whatever. And trickery for what person? For what purpose? To get what you want. Life dominated by desire. Life dominated by desire is going to employ deceitfulness. Why not? Gets me what I want. Can you see how much that stands in the way of love for the brother? If your approach to other people has deceit in it? Deceit about myself, that becomes the special one. The one that's next. Pretending to be something else. Do you remember the phrase that came down here in 1 Timothy? Having a form of God, having the appearance of godliness, but denying the real power of it. That comes up in hypocrisy. I'm going to pretend to have something that I don't really have. Deceitfulness, trickery of a person who's out to deceive others so he can get achieve his or her ends, own ends. Hypocrisy is acting apart from seeing true motives. What about envy? What about envy? Wanting what somebody else, yeah, but envy's more than that. Envy's more than that. Envy is hating them for having it. Or at least it edges up on that. Envy says, why do you have that and I don't? Now, something happened within the last 2 weeks, but it's just about the most beautiful counterexample I have ever seen. There's a national scholarship called the Goldwater Scholarships. These are given specifically to science and math students who are in college and preparing for careers as scientists and mathematicians. Obviously, that's near and dear to my heart. It was given by Congress. It's apportioned by Congress every year in honor of Barry Goldwater, who was a senator from Arizona for years and years and years. And these are given, I think, by state. They may be given by congressional district, but the information doesn't come back that way. It comes back by state. So the competition is a little different in each state. Some states, the competition may be a little higher, some a little lower. Every university is invited to nominate students to receive a Goldwater Fellowship. It is approaching the sort of stamp of sorts that the Rhodes Scholarships have. It's just not quite as well known because it's much more narrow focused. You may not be aware there's Marshall Scholarships, there's Rhodes Scholarships, and Goldwater is sort of the third of those. Marshall and Rhodes Scholarships tend to be disciplined, unspecific. You can be studying whatever you like. Goldwater is very, very focused. And so it's a mark of some distinction for a student to get one and for a university to be the one that sponsored them. Okay? Until about 4 years ago, the University of Richmond had never gotten one. And about 4 years ago, they asked me to take charge of it for a year. We nominated 3 people. 2 of them got it. I felt pretty good. Next year, went back. Had somebody else do that, and they got one more. The third one that I nominated that didn't get one the first year got one the next year. Feeling pretty good. It brought me back into the process this year, so I got to watch it up close. 3 kids were nominated. Now listen carefully. 2 of them got it, 1 of them didn't. That's great, right? The kids who didn't get it came running into my office He says, Dr. Myers, Chris says Brian got the gold waters. Isn't this great? Now you think about what that kid just said to me. He doesn't know what he said. Chris, he didn't get one. And he's in my office with this big grin on his face. And he says, Kristen and Brian, one gold waters. Isn't it great? He was competing in New York. You compete in your home state. In your home state, you know, it's not Richmond's in Virginia, so everybody from Richmond competes in Virginia. You compete in your home state. He was competing in New York, and the competition in New York is stiff. He didn't get one. He could not, I think, have been any happier if he got one himself. I was stunned. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I don't see that very often. And boy, does it move me when I do. What's the opposite? The opposite is what they're talking about. He demonstrated for me this, the love for the brothers, in a way that I hadn't seen in a long time. And he did it by going the exact opposite of envy. We can't love each other if we cannot truly be happy when something good happens to a brother and sister. No shadow, no nothing. Truly happy when something good happens to somebody else. That turns out to be hard. The disciples couldn't do that. The disciples couldn't do that. They were still arguing within a fairly short time before the cross which one's going to be the most important in the kingdom. They were still arguing about things like that. They were still fighting. That kind of, wait a second, I'm going to have to be first. Remember what Jesus did the last night he was here? Put a towel around his waist and wash their feet. Why did he do that? Because they were all still fighting on who was going to be first. What's the third one? Now, this is the one that in my translation is called carping criticism. You remember my inviting you to keep your eye on one? Malicious gossip. That says it about as well. Carping criticism. I have one here that says disparaging gossip. Gossip that is meant to hurt. Gossip that is meant to tear down. Comments behind the back that are meant to undermine and to destroy. Love for the brothers can't survive if that goes on. Do you see how I'm connecting chapter 2, verse 1, with what came before? Christ's less life looks like this. Christ's still life looks like that. And the big one is the love for the brothers. You may remember in John, Jesus said, it's by your love for one another that people will know that you are Christians and that people will know that God sent me. We haven't figured out how to love each other. What's going to happen? Our witness to the world is going to collapse. So chapter 2, verse 1, he says, set these things aside. Strip these things off. Rid yourself of these things. Because if these are still there, you're not ever going to be able to achieve what the Christ-filled life is really trying to achieve. Now we're almost done. We're almost done. Now take a look at verse 2. Like newborn babies, all of your longing should be for milk. The unadulterated spiritual milk, which will help you grow up to salvation, if at any rate you've tasted that the Lord is good. We don't have much time, so let me summarize. A lot of people think that the first part of 1 Peter was written for who? This is a test. People who were probably just being baptized, new Christians. And so here, the writer is praising people who are looking for milk. There are other places in the New Testament where that's criticized, but not here. Not here. Unadulterated milk, he says. The milk of the Word in some translations. Have I told you lately that I have a grandson? He came over last Sunday, and he's come over a couple of other times. One of those times, Barbara got to feed him. He is now beginning to eat solid food. He's passed that magic point. It's time. Okay? And instructions came to Barbara. When you feed him, make sure you give him his rice cereal first. Because once he tastes the sweet potatoes, he's not going to want to eat the rice. Well, Barbara's an old hand at this, so she kept feeding him both, and he never knew which one was coming, and he'd start it down, and then he'd figure out, wait, that wasn't the one, and okay, it was the one, and, you know, you go back and forth, you'd feed the whole thing. She said that baby just took it all away, just ate it all up. Picture that, a hungry baby, eating the stuff that's good for him. The milk, the baby cereal, all that kind of stuff. He says, be like that about the Word. And the Word is a double meaning. The Word means Scripture itself, and the Word means Jesus himself. If that becomes the focus of our work, that we continue to be hungry for that, then the other things will come in place. You rid yourself of those things and don't put something in their place, that won't work. That's probably enough for today. We'll start somewhere after verse 3 next time. And we'll hope to see all of you next week. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time we have to study your words and for you to teach us through those words how you want us to live and how you want us to conduct our business and our lives and how you want us to love each other. Teach us how to do that. And thank you for those examples when we see people around us who are able to begin to mirror you. All this we pray in your Son's name, and especially on this day when we think about his coming to die for us. For we ask it in his name. Amen.